You've tuned into High Voltage, where rock lives, breathes, and hits you right in the chest. I'm Nelson Aldridge, and joined always by my co-pilot and my father, Stuart Aldridge. Welcome, Stu.
Thanks, Nels. We're back again.
We are back again. Yeah. We're bringing you the tracks and the stories, the voltage to charge up your day. And our guest today is none other than Brian Canham, who is an Australian singer, songwriter, and producer, best known as being the frontman of Pseudo Echo, one of the defining bands of the 1980s new wave and synth pop era. Formed in Melbourne, Pseudo Echo rose to international fame with a global hit Funky Town, alongside classics like Listening and A Beat For You. Beyond his work with the band, Brian has built a respected career as a producer and mentor, contributing significantly to the Australian music industry while continuing to perform and record with Pseudo Echo decades after their breakthrough. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. God, that was a good introduction.
It was great.
Can you do that for me at the local post office when I go next time?
I can do that wherever you want.
Wow.
Well, I'm glad I've started well. It's a good start to the interview today. Yeah. No, well, Brian, you've actually been on... Well, we've done an interview before a couple of years ago. Bit of a different concept. Yeah. But it's great to have you back.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back. We'll start off pretty much the same, though, of you just giving the audience a bit of an insight of where you grew up and... how you started getting into music.
Yeah, well, as a young lad, I reckon I had a guitar pretty much my whole life. So that was pointing me in the right direction. I've had a few motorbikes in my life and mini bikes when I was a kid. So that pointed me in a slightly different direction. But fortunately, the music I followed through with. And by the time I was about 14, I was in a band.
Yeah, awesome.
Probably a crap one, but you know, it was a band nonetheless.
And playing guitar.
Yeah. And I did various bands till I was about sort of 18, 19. You know, just trying to hold it together more than, you know, it was always sort of getting into a more positive direction. And by the time I was about sort of maybe even in my late teens, I was so fed up with egos of lead singers and people just not turning up, and they were slack asses. So I ended up just by default taking over the reins of the vocalist, and that seemed to be easier. It was less people to sort of organise. So I thought, well, I'll just do that. And besides, you know, one of my idols, Jimi Hendrix, he played guitar and sung. So I thought, well
you could do it.
Seems like a good idea. Yeah. Doesn't matter if he's playing the other way around, but you know. And so Pseudo's pretty well. Was born off the back of those little garage bands. I went to high school with Pierre, the bass keyboard player, and he was just playing traditional bass back in the day, and we had started sort of, you know, hearing these new bands that were coming out of Europe, and they would have been, you know, Simple Minds, Ultravox, and Spandau Ballet, even
Duran
in their early days. And so these bands were influencing me, and you know, I'd heard Gary Numan and Tubeway Army, and started saying, you know, there's something different about these bands. This amazing unique sound, and then I you know, it took me a while to realise it was just lots of keyboards, and keyboards weren't really readily available when I was sort of at that point in my life. Everyone played bass, guitar, or drums. To know somebody who played keyboard, they either played on a piano and practiced inside and couldn't, you know, drag it into the garage to play on. So
unless you were John Lord or someone.
That's right. So it was a limited instrument in the neighbourhood, and so I knew that's the sound I wanted, and so one day, one of our bands, I think the last band we did before Pseudos was called Secret Agents, and it was kind of new wave, punky new wave, and so we just sort of, as we'd been listening to these songs, we said, let's get a keyboard. I think we bought a synthesizer or a keyboard before we had a keyboard player,
okay. And
it was just a crappy little one, and we mucked around with that and tried some sounds in the band. We could hear straight away that it was taking us to a new level, a different sound, so... We ended up being introduced through a few mutual friends to our first keyboard player, Tony Lugton, and then Pierre swapped from bass guitar to bass synth, and that became Pseudo Echo. And, you know, like Suits, we toured, we played around locally just in Melbourne, and then maybe the first gigs were in Sydney, which we drove all the way with all of us in one little coupe. And, you know, we gigged around for a good 12 months, and within that time, it was pretty amazing to think what we actually achieved. I look back at it now, and I think that it's, you know, most bands would be rapt if that was their, you know, it was just such a short jump, because, you know, we struggled around forever as teenagers. By the time I hit my 20s, within 12 months, we were on Countdown, you know, had met Molly, got a record deal and had a song in the charts.
Yeah.
So it sort of happened really quick when it happened.
Yeah, and back then there was a lot of live venues as well.
Absolutely.
To play at, wasn't
there, you know? Yeah, we were playing all the time.
All the time, yeah.
And we, like, you know, we just, we were convenient to have on the bill. We didn't have a drummer back then. It was just a drum machine.
Yeah.
So they probably, you know, they could see, look, you got
easy punching information.
Get them on, yeah. Get them off. You know? So we'd open for so many bands, you know, we'd get this opening spot. So we really got our fair share of openers.
Exposure.
Yeah, and that really helped. And I think in every time we played, you know, people that talk about us and try to pronounce our name. And
yeah, yeah. We're talking about it before. Yeah. Like Pseudo or
yeah, we got a lot of variations of that.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So those things all contributed to the whole, you know, getting it together as Suits. And then I think by the time we did that Countdown appearance that Molly introduced us to Australia, we... it kind of just bolted after that. And, you know, EMI, you know, put their hand up, and as did a lot of labels, but EMI were... they had the right kind of acts on their label that we wanted to associate with, and they could see where we were going. Because you've got to remember, it was off the back of the rock and the punk movement.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was new territory. You know, what we were doing, a lot of people weren't sure about.
Absolutely.
You know, if they couldn't see a conventional drummer or a drum kit, and, you know, couldn't see conventional bass, all they were seeing on stage with Pseudos was keyboards and electronic stuff.
Yeah, well, Australia was ACDC, Rage Tattoo, and Dragon.
That's
what it was happening.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a new territory.
Yeah, yeah, it was good.
Yeah, fantastic.
No, it's good. And in the 80s, as you were saying, because all the electric drums and the synths started coming in, so I guess it was just a gravitational pull of, it's something different and unique, because as you were saying, you know, you've got all those other bands that you had to stand out, and was that one of the key things of going, this is a good way to stand out?
And look, it took us a few years to find our thing, because initially, as I said, we didn't have a drummer. It was just fully electronic, and that was a bit limiting because, you know, you watch an artist on stage, if there's no drummer up there, it can be really lacking energy. There's no driving force. You're hearing it these days, I guess it's more acceptable.
It is,
but,
yeah,
but when we were making that breakthrough, it was off the back of your classic pub rock, so it was very scary territory. So we experimented. We ended up, you know, getting a drummer, recruiting Anthony Aguirre on drums, but we used an electronic drum kit. And we had to import that from the UK. There was none in Australia. We had to call them up at midnight or something and talk to them over the phone, and, you know, with delays and everything, and then try and track somebody down. We knew we had a credit card.
Yeah, right.
So we could buy the thing and have it freighted over.
I guess there was bands like ABBA as well. You never seen them on stage or on video clips with drummers. They were drum machines too, do you think?
No, I think they had the musos at the back.
Okay, yeah, okay.
They had very traditional instrumentation. Yeah. They had, top session guys.
Yeah.
But, yeah, with Pseudos, that step, getting an electronic drum kit, taking the bass out and putting an electronic bass synthesizer instead, and then, you know, we just kind of approached our songs a different way. Like, some of the songs when we started were very traditional songs. They just sounded like an ordinary traditional song, but by the time we redid them and swapped out the sounds and then, you know, messed with the arrangements and made the melody sound a little bit more monotone and a little bit deeper, and you know, we managed to find this sound. And I think you know, when I was in my early 20s, I was still probably mimicking the bands that I was idolizing, but I probably wasn't that good at mimicking, so we ended up finding our own thing by default.
So what was your first guitar you bought, and do you still have it?
Well, funny thing is, first guitar, well, I can't even remember. I think I had a no-brand Japanese thing that I bought for $27.
Right.
It was $30, and my brother negotiated down $3 for me.
Yeah.
So he was still a wheeler dealer. Well,
2 packs of smokes back then, $3.
That's right. And I had that for a while. And then I recently published a story on my Facebook that people can check out about this guitar, this other guitar that I found. But, as I said, I pretty much always had a guitar. There was just a few times, I don't know, between guitars, or I, you know, got rid of one and maybe bought a mini bike instead, or you know, went off the track. But I really pined for having a guitar again when I didn't have one. And I had a family friend, it was an older guy, and he had a couple of guitars. And so he said to me, look, if you ever want to borrow mine, you can borrow them. And of course I took him up on it straight away. I used to walk about a kilometre through the northern suburbs to his house, knock on the door. If he was home, he was home. If he wasn't, he wasn't, because we didn't have phones and stuff that you could, you know, mobiles of it. And he just loaned me this guitar, and he'd give it to me. It was a little Sakai SG kind of looking thing, a little white sort of Gibson clone.
Yeah.
And he would give that to me over a period of 2 years. I must have had it nearly all of 2 years. And I played that thing to death. And it wasn't until, you know, like a few years down where I repurchased a guitar again for myself, a bit, you know, slightly better one, still a Jap copy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they were golden days, like, to think. And the funny thing is I've often wondered about that guitar, because I gave it back to him eventually.
Okay.
And I've always kept my eye out for them. They're rare guitar. Not extremely valuable or anything, but just unusual. They were, you know, they were just...
what was the brand, did you say?
Sakai. Sakai, okay. Yeah. And so recently I just was looking through some classifieds and one popped up. And I couldn't believe it, you know. And you got to remember, the guy that loaned me the guitar, he passed away in the 90s, I think, in the early 90s. And so I never really thanked him enough for, you know... He knew that I succeeded with the band and things happened in the music industry. He was extremely proud of that. But I never really... I would have loved to see the guitar again and talk to him about it. And so I came across this guitar identical to the one that I had, so I snapped it up and it was the most nostalgic feeling, sitting with this guitar on my leg while I'm playing it and just thinking, wow, this is... And so, I went through my photo album and found a picture of me playing it and made a little now and then sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, they're special. They have real meaning to us. So I have repurchased a lot of the guitars that I had when I was a kid just because they were so significant in shaping how I looked at things. I mean, you know... We all just had these sort of conventional-looking guitars, and there was one time my teacher in the northern suburbs, he had a little music shop, and he'd just bring in, you know, hand-picked little collection of guitars. And that's usually my source of where I'd buy a guitar, especially if I was buying a new guitar. And one day he got this guitar in, and I'd never seen anything like it. It's called an Ibanez Artist. Ibanez make lots of artists, but this one in particular looked like something, you know, Paul Stanley would play. It was black and gold and had stars on it, and it was so fancy I couldn't believe it. And so I think my dad, being a key muso and always wanting me to, you know, to pursue music, he said, I'll buy it for you.
Awesome.
It was such a score. So I had that for many years, right up till Pseudo Echo. And then by the time I did Pseudos, it was the wrong look then. I thought, it's too rock and I need something more modern and edgy. So I passed it on.
Did you?
And I never saw it again. And it was another one of those very rare guitars. But I've since have found one again and have one in my collection now. So it's pretty much identical, and they're rare as hell. But, it's funny, these guitars, how they the significance they have, you know, in your life.
Absolutely.
What were you spoke about Jimi Hendrix before. I'm always big on listening to other artists about who their influences are. Was it just Hendrix, or were there, I mean, there's a lot of great guitarists in that era.
Yeah. Jose Feliciano.
Yep.
Puerto Rican guitarist. I mean, not only an amazing singer, soulful singer, but I loved his guitar playing, you know, nylon guitar, you know, different style altogether. But it was just an early influence that my parents used to listen to a lot, and that sort of influenced me. But I would say, you know, David Gilmour, you know, I mean, he's possibly the most melodic guitar player in history.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page, my God, you know, Ritchie Blackmore. So all those sort of 70s. Iconic rock bands, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, even Scorpions, Uli Roth, I love
his poem.
Yeah, so that's right. Yeah. So they're all classic, you know, mainly they hang around the pentatonic scale for those who are musical, and that was good for me. Five notes and a sixth one if you're lucky. But yeah, so they were big, big influences. And I think for me, once again, I never really used to be so obsessive that I would mimic anyone. I probably didn't have the ability to mimic them at close when I was that young, but I would sort of listen and then I would just do my version of what I was hearing. Mm. And I think these are the things that help you find your sound, sort of not even intentionally. You just sort of stumble on your own thing because it's probably a crappier version of the one you're really idolising, but then you turn it into your thing.
And eventually
that's it. It becomes your sound. So, you know... So, like, for instance, when you hear the guitar solo in Funky Town, which is one of the few that I really rip on, that I got a chance to do that, because Pseudo's been predominantly synth-based. So, by the time that came and I said, I'm going to put a solo in here, I'm going to do it with a vengeance.
Yep.
And I can hear in there so many of my influences. The introduction to the solo with the big dive bomb, I mean, that's a Jimi Hendrix technique. So,
yeah,
you know, right. I always knew that I was going to be putting that in my solo somewhere.
What I love about with guitars and stuff, you can do this with a lot of musicians, obviously, yeah. is just know straight away. Yesterday I was listening to, I had Pink Floyd Wish You Were Here vinyl on, and the Have a Cigar solo. And I'm like, my God. Every time I listen to David Gilmour, and Pink Floyd's one of them bands that they can be so slow.
Yeah.
And bang.
Yeah, yeah. Gilmour's an incredibly melodic guitar player. He's not about flashy shredding. It's beautiful, soulful, melodic. Yeah. And his technique, his sound,
Mark Knopfler was a little bit similar type.
Yeah, Knopfler's an amazing guitar player.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
You know, these guitarists, they really find their sound.
Yeah.
But I think it's easily underrated with guitar players because, you know, people go, oh, you know, he's got this setup and he's got that gear and all this, but, you know, a good guitar player, they can play a broomstick and make it sound good. It's all in their hands. When we were touring last year, we did some shows with Southern Sons and Jack Jones such a great guitar player.
Yeah,
he's a great guy.
I've seen him play with the Hans Valen tribute years ago.
Shred, he can play this way, that way. But, you know, when I was watching their set, I was really listening to his playing. I said, what the hell is, you know, how does he get that tone? And I'm looking at it's his hands. He's got incredible vibrato, control over the notes and things. And, you know, and I love it when you hear it. And that's what Jimi Hendrix had.
Yeah.
Jimmy was messy. He was loose. He was, you know, adventurous. He would just rip into it. He'd, you know, roll his guitar into the mic stand and use it like a slide. And
did you hear what anyone thought?
Yeah, he'd hit the tremolo. And in those days, tremolos were so bad to do. Like, if he couldn't do a dive bomb on a Fender Strat stand, it'd be all out of tune.
Yeah.
But he'd just push it out of tune and then somehow manage to pull it back into tune by bending it. You know, he'd grab the machine heads and tune it on the run while he's playing to bring it back into tune.
Yeah. I love the story of Paul McCartney tells it, the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's, like, literally the day, and then they went and watched Hendrix because the Beatles were massive Hendrix fans. Day after, he saw them rock in, and all of a sudden he started playing Sgt. Pepper's, and Paul McCartney goes, but he did it in his own way and better.
That's one of my favourite things with Hendrix was the covers he did.
Yeah.
And most people don't realise he didn't write many songs. He just reinterpreted them. But when I say just reinterpreted them, he did incredible reinterpretations.
Yeah.
He really took them to a new level. Like, you know, I didn't know that Dylan wrote All Along the Watchtower. I thought it was Jimi Hendrix, you know.
So it
was funny because when I heard the original, I was like, huh, okay, right. Yeah. Where's all the bits, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
where's the flash?
Steve Ray Vaughan's another guitarist too, was just out of this world for me. I just love to listen to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Tone monsters.
Amazing.
I can go on forever, but, you know, these guys were all, mainly 70s guitarists, was definitely the golden era for me.
Well, how's the way that, like, you know, you have the Yardbirds and three of the greatest guitarists ever at the same time, Jeff Beck, Clapton and Jimmy Page.
I know, God.
How do you do that? How do you pull that off?
I know, God, you know, make some room. Like, I mean, you know, Jimmy Page, I mean, you know, as a kid, you know, hearing Led Zeppelin and, you know, I mostly was just, you know, miming with a cricket bat, you know, back then. And I'd hear, you know, the latest Zeppelin album, I'll put it on, and, you know, okay, this is A Whole Lot of Love. I could play that. And so, you know, I'm jamming along, and, you know, that the middle section of that song, when it breaks down and he just rips into a guitar solo without the band, like, you know, it just stops, and all of a sudden he just takes the stage, and it's like, oh my God, it's like the most, you know, classic guitar solo lick in the middle of a song that I've ever heard, you know. And I think there's something about this that is so bold, and they just take it and really go for it. So they were all my real influences.
Yeah,
awesome. And you've got a few siblings, yeah?
I have.
And any of them musicians at all?
I have to think about how many I had. between record, it's like a Brady Bunch. you know, my boy Escher, apart from, you know, looking like a clone of me, as a little kid, he showed real promise on guitar. He looked like Jimi Hendrix when he played it.
Yeah, right.
He had all the moves, and he was, you know, really soulful, and he was mucking around with it. I'm talking about when he's about Yeah. He just really, I bought him this little scale down guitar and an amp, and he was great. But he just sort of, I think, you know, it depends. You know, I think you've got to have, your parents need to be
influencing you a bit.
Yeah, yeah. United together to guide you that way. And I thought, well, I don't want to be one of these parents who puts a guitar in his hand and really push him too much. I want him to find his way. So it just wasn't his thing in the end. He's still incredibly knowledgeable and musical in that way that he can understand what's going on. But, I didn't pursue it with him. But, yeah, he's still 23. It's not too late.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, George Benson took up guitar at 17.
Yeah.
And to think, you know, God, how do you start at 17 and be that good, you know? That was sort of one of the steps for me that I always knew that you know, that legend that he'd started that young.
Mm.
That late in life, rather. And so I thought, well, there's hope for me.
That's right.
But, you know, I was probably started seriously taking lessons by 13, 14, maybe.
Yep. Well, hey, what we'll do is we're going to jump to a song in a minute, but I want to talk about an album that came out in, I believe, 1985, Love and Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
So we've jumped past Autumnal Park, but I want to talk about Love and Adventure quickly because it was 40 years ago, only like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
How was that when, you know, we're sitting there writing that, coming out? Great album.
There was a real change in the band because the first album was much darker and the whole approach of how we recorded it was different to Love and Adventure. Technology changed.
Yep.
The digital age started happening. So first album was fully analogue, which meant we had tape recorders and, you know, each instrument played on a separate channel and you sort of... It was more traditional, even though we're playing electronic music. The recording process was traditional. Whereas the Love and Adventure album, there was the advent of digital recording. Digital recording and samplers. Samplers was the biggest new thing. This is sort of 85, 86, and you're talking about technology where you could make a sound, record a sound, and then play it off a keyboard. So that was a whole new thing. And so we really took advantage of that. We programmed the majority of the drums on that album. They were sampled and programmed, and we got sounds from all sorts of places. We were so experimental with it. Even guitar bits and pieces. I think on Love and Adventure, one of the songs, I used a sample of Steve Lukather's guitar off Toto. Because the guy that was working with us, the producer, had just done a mix for Toto and had some of the raw samples. And so I remember getting this guitar chord and put it into a sampler and then playing it off the keyboard in the different notes. And so it's living in a dream, I think. I put it just in the choruses underneath my guitar. There's a bit of Toto in there.
Right.
So,
oh, that's all right.
Yeah, that was one of the big differences with that album, was technology was the main thing. Yeah. And apart from that, the songwriting changed dramatically because I was predominantly writing with, well, I was always about, you know, 70% of the main writer, and the rest I would write with some of the other members. And so first album was with our first keyboard player, Tony Lugden, a little bit of Pierre, and some with Anthony. And then by the second album, the major thing that changed was I introduced James Lee, the young keyboard player, into the band. And he had lots of good ideas. He had heaps of riffs, and he was quite fanatical with his keyboards. And so I started writing with James, and that was a big difference with those two albums. So the second album is more up, sort of vibey, majory sounding. Any of the dark songs in, they'll be the old ones that I had prior. It changed in that way dramatically, and you know, the whole production's a bit more sparkly and vibey and pop.
And it's a great album cover.
Cover,
I love it. It's fun.
That was the drummer from that band, The Swingers, Buster Stiggs.
Yep.
He was a graphic designer, and he's passed away some 10, 20 years ago. He was such a great artist, and it was so cool to get, like, one of your peers in the industry that we looked up to. To come in and do it. And so we had a chat, and we talked about stuff from my childhood and what influenced me and, you know, the adventure games and you know, toys we used to play with and things like this. So he had this idea. He said, all right, I'm going to put all that together and I'm going to come up with something. And it was so cool.
Yeah. Well, let's jump to a song. Let's jump to Love and Adventure, and we'll come back after this and we'll talk about Funky Town and how that comes to be. And, stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Great music, great fun. It's just got to be Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
Welcome back to High Voltage. We're here with Brian Canham, and we've been talking a bit about Brian's life, how he got into music, playing guitar, some of his influences, the early days of Pseudo Echo. And now we're back. That was Love and Adventure, by the way. And now we're back with, we're going to talk a little bit about an upcoming tour that Brian's got, a 40-year anniversary of one of, arguably, the biggest international hits by an Australian band, which is Funky Town, that came out in 1986. And Funky Town, Brian, if I tell the story correctly, of course you will know, is you originally heard the song going into a club which was being DJed by Molly Meldrum.
Right on.
That's and that,
right.
That's where you first heard the song.
Yeah.
So Molly essentially introduced you to Funky Town, and then few years later you thought, I'm going to rejig this and I'm going to have a crack. So
yeah, so we, as you said, that was how I heard the first version of it, Molly DJing it. And it had such an impact on me that I just sort of carried it with me all that time, inspirational production ideas, arrangement ideas. And it was probably 5 years later that Pseudos were just off the back. We just released the Love and Adventure album, because Funky Town wasn't on the Love and Adventure album on the initial cut. We hadn't thought of it. We just did the Love and Adventure album. We were touring it, and we're probably on the last tour of it. I'd caught up with a guy during the tour, a friend of mine who was a DJ. While we're having coffee, he's going through his vinyl, and he just puts on the old Funky Town. And we're having a laugh. I said, wow, that's taking me back, you know. 5 years earlier when you're 20s and very nostalgic.
It was a long time, 5 years. Yeah,
it was the old days. You know, I sort of got a bit of a vibe. And so at the next sound check, where we did most of our experimentation and noodling and mucking around, rather than sound checking, I started jamming a bit of Funky Town. I had to change the key because it was in such a weird key, because it was a female vocal originally. And so I had to sort of really bastardize it and move it around, and ended up going all the way down to E on the guitar. It sounded real good, real grungy and, you know, dark down there. I thought, this is cool. And so, you know, Pierre starts, you know, doing the bass line, and then the drummer jumps in, and then we just sort of fudged jammed our way it. Through it, jammed it.
Yeah.
And we said, hey, let's put it in the encore tonight. Can't be that hard. It's only got about five chords. And so we put it in the encore, and it just went mental. We couldn't believe how... We just thought, you know, it could be mixed results. They could be sort of laughing along with us, or, you know, you're doing an old disco song. And it just, it went over so well that it stayed in the set for the rest of the tour. It's the encore song. And by the time we finished the tour, I started kind of thinking about, you know, should I do something with this? And I bumped into Lee Simon, who was the CEO or main program director at Triple M at the time. And he said to me, you got to release that song. And I didn't really know what he was talking about. And I said, which song is that? And he said, Funky Town. I said, hey, do you know we play that? And he goes, oh, I managed to get a disc tape of one of your gigs. I said, oh, that's good. I didn't even know about that. So, and he was so vibed up about it. And I said, well, that's pretty convincing.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I did mention it to Glenn, our manager, Glenn Wheatley, he was sort of a bit lukewarm. He wasn't sure. He's older and he can still... connected to the 70s disco scene. So he was sort of going, oh, I don't know about that. And I said, yeah, but Glenn, you know, we're really, really, you know, vibing it up here. It's changing. It's much more rocky. So when Lee kind of gave him that sort of opinion, I think that really turned him around. So the green flag was ready to go, and we were ready to, you know, it was talked about, record company, the same. They had a little bit of reservation, weren't sure about a disco song in the 80s. But I assured him I had all these ideas. So I said, look, I'll take the reins as a producer because I know exactly what I want to do with it.
Yeah.
So we took it into the studio. We even took in our original demo, the 12-track that we recorded our demo. We even took the whole console into the studio, because some things we captured so sort of vibey on the demo that I said, I think I took the bass synth off the demo and put it in there.
Yeah.
And some of the drum bits and pieces, and I just redid the guitars and the vocals. And by the time we finished the recording and played it to them, they were all gobsmacked, and they said, yeah, we're all on board now.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, there was this incredible vibe behind the song then, and so it was pretty much an instant hit. It just raced up the charts. Mm. You know, there was talk then how what album is it going to be on, because you got this massive hit. And then it started happening around the world, and we went to the States, we're touring in the US, and it was belting up the charts while we were there. And when we started the tour, so the tour was booked before we released it, and by the time we were midway of the tour, it was in the top 20 in the US and heading for the top position. And our tour was coming to an end, and we're thinking, oh, shit, our timing's terrible here because we're sort of off the back of this tour. But strangely enough, we played all these college circuits in the States. We played, must have played to tens and tens of thousands of college students, and played Funky Town at the gig, and it was hitting the charts at the same time. So by the time we left and finished the tour and came back home, it was in the top five or something in the US.
Amazing.
I mean, the extended mix went to number one on the Billboard chart. We couldn't believe it. You know,
unreal, isn't it? All that just from a jam.
It was just a jam.
Yeah, bang.
That's incredible.
Fantastic.
So that essentially shifted you into one of the few Australian bands that had massive international success.
That's right.
Yeah, it just snowballed. You know, there was hardly any kind of real marketing strategy that was employed. It was literally a snowball effect.
Yeah.
One station after another, they just kept jumping on it, and it was like wildfire, just took off. And then before we knew it, we had a hit with it around the world. It was a massive in Sweden and Greece and, you know, right through Europe, really.
Amazing, yeah. I could be wrong, but I believe it was number one in 28 countries.
Something like that. It was mental.
That's mental.
Yeah.
That is mental.
Absolutely.
And still widely played today.
Yeah, yeah. So it's been the best calling card you could have.
Yeah. Well, it's easily, you could argue, the greatest cover song. You know, we were talking about Hendrix before, Volo on the Watchtower. It's probably in that category, in that territory of, you know.
Definitely is.
For sure. Yeah. No, that's incredible. You know, as I said, international success. And when you talk about some other bands that are obviously massive here in Australia, we're talking about Cold Chisel and the Angels and them, they didn't have very little.
I think that it's, look, it's an identity with Australian bands, you know. Those bands that you mentioned, they just own the Australian culture. They really are the epitome of Australian rock bands. I chose to go a different path. And I always have. If there's too many this way, I'll go the other way. So for me, that wasn't where I was going to go, because it was way too much competition. And to be honest, at the time, I didn't think I was that good. So I thought, well, I better just go a different way. That way I can't be directly compared, and so that's why we headed off into that direction.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great direction. And to be honest, for me, you're a couple of years older than myself, but Judo Echo was never on my radar as a person growing up. I was that Australian bogany type.
That's right.
Rock.
Absolutely.
Band thing. And then when I first met you and and I said, are you a musician? You said, yeah, I am. Have you heard of a band called Judo Echo? I said, yeah, mate, yeah. You said, well, I'm Brian Cannon. I said, well, there you go. So that was quite amazing, wasn't it?
That was good,
yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, to have that kind of thing happen to you at the peak of your career, then another song just goes mental.
It's great.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Very exciting for you, would have been.
Yeah. And then obviously it's 40 years since then, which is probably, hearing me say that's probably like Jesus.
Yeah. It's just, the weirdest thing is it's very surreal. It doesn't feel like 40 years at all because it's never really left my side. I mean, I've been doing pseudos. I took maybe a decade off where I did music production, scoring and jingles. Lots of jingles I wrote. And so I did that for a good decade, and then it was after that that I'd been producing other bands, and then I thought a lot of the bands were saying to me, you know, what are you doing? You got this great band, you should put it back together. And so I just resurrected it, you know, in a new version, and pretty much since then it's evolved to where it is today. And these days it's quite a different band, but it's essentially the sound is identical.
I've got
a six-piece band. I've got a couple of girls in the band these days. They're a younger band. They're very vibey, and they take great pride in replicating the sound how it was.
And you've got a great manager behind the scenes.
That's
right. Doing all that.
Wifey Raquel
Your
here.
Wife Raquel.
Off mic. She's not coming over. But that's just, you know, made it stay the test of time, really, because we just kept adjusting it to tweak it, to get it right, to get the right dynamics, to keep it vibey rather than If I'd stayed with the old lineup, it might have been four grumpy men on stage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we did try that, but it was very grumpy, so it wasn't much fun. So at the expense of, yes, oh, it's not the original guys in there, it was worth it to have a show that had real energy and positive vibes.
Yeah. Punch you in the gut.
There's not many bands left with the original members left anyway. Is
for good reason, usually.
That's right.
Well, you got a tour coming up. You got the 40 years of the tour. Yep, Funky Town tour. So give us a bit of an insight of that, of where you'll be going and when that kicks off.
Yeah, it's a national tour. Kicks off in a couple of weeks.
February the 6th.
3 weeks, yep. And,
at the Gov in Adelaide.
In the Gov in Adelaide. And the thing, I guess, look, you know, we tweaked the set a little bit and, you know, a few new things in the visuals and the whole show. And the new thing we've done is the remix album, which is the Machine Remixes, which I've... most bands don't do their remixes. They usually give it out to somebody to do, but I'm incredibly protective about that and I like to have my stamp on my own stuff, and I'm not super mad about somebody else doing their thing with it, and then I get all the pats on the back because it feels like you didn't do it. It's like, yeah, you love your remix. Well, I didn't do it.
Yeah, that's
go
right.
Go and thank them. But so, you know, look, I thought if I do the remixes, it's going to be a lot more pseudo echo. And which they've so far, how they're shaping up, that's exactly what's happening. They're just pseudo echo on steroids. And Funky Town's one of the mixes. So I'm doing all the singles pretty much.
Yep.
Give or take, and they are these real modern trip on what was original. So they're quite reinvented, and we use them as part of the show, as in sometimes they'll be the intro or the outro. We still play the classic versions live because we don't want to mess with that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so down the line there may be some other type of DJ tour or something like that that will highlight and showcase the remixes album. But, yeah, it's been a lot of fun and really well received with our fans so far too.
Love it. Yeah, so make sure you jump online to grab a ticket to go and see Pseudo Echo playing their Funky Town tour. That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Might have to tread along ourselves.
What about the Quick Five?
Yes, in the car on the way down here, Dad mentioned something about a Quick Five.
Got to do a Quick Five.
Okay.
This is the first time this is being done for everyone listening at home, okay, so bear with us. Have you got questions?
No, you have, Amy.
Oh, my God. All right. We'll just make some up on the spot then. All right, Brian, here we go. Okay, Brian, favourite song growing up?
Oh, God, favourite song growing up.
Band, song, album, whatever.
On the spot now.
Well, we'll take it. Growing up, all right. Let's just
all along watch
now. You know what? I'll go a cryptic one. Yep. By the time I was say 14, stumbled on a record by a band called Styx, American band, STYX. It was about their sixth album or something like that, and I accidentally put on side two. First time I ever heard it. I just liked the cover. It had a fantastic cover, sort of a reworking of a Magritte painting. And I drew my eye to it, and I put the first song that I heard was track one on side two. It was a song called Miss America. Yeah. And it had the most blistering guitar intro that I've heard as a kid. Probably strongly influenced my guitar intro on Funky Town.
Yeah, right.
So that would be that one.
And your first international band you saw live? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go back probably 50 years now.
Yeah, like, Jesus. 45. Well... it's the international band. I'm thinking of all the bands. They're all bloody local. I saw the Zoot. They were local.
The Zoot, local. I've seen the Zoot too.
Yeah,
they were good. Great showgrounds. They were great.
Yeah, they were good. It was when Rick was in it, and they were killing it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the Stranglers. Okay. Strangely enough, no one even knows who they are. You know, Golden Brown. And before they had that success with those songs, they were kind of much more of a punk band. And there was a little bit of time where I went through a punk scene.
Yeah.
It wasn't very long.
No. Well, it was highly influenced punk, wasn't it? The British era of punk.
Yeah, so
Sex Pistols and all
those. I saw the Stranglers at Festival Hall and I was pretty impressed, you know.
Yeah.
All right, back to me, is it?
Yeah, back to you.
All right. Brian, favourite gig you've ever played?
Wow. Well,
there's a lot of them to choose from, Mike.
Yeah, God, there's a lot of gigs.
Palms?
Do you know any? The Ritz, I was going to say. Yeah.
The Ritz
in New York.
Wow.
So we were, that was our first sort of big city show in the States. And Yeah, it was packed, and it was recorded live for an MTV special.
What's the capacity there? Do you remember?
A couple of thousand.
Okay.
Yeah. Good size venue. And yeah. And it was a great show, but unfortunately at the gig, one of the cameramen accidentally tripped on a power cord and ripped out the power to one of our samplers, and so half our sound was missing.
Oh, my God.
But we managed to get through the show, and the vibe was great. We fixed it up afterwards in the studio for the recording. Everyone was saying, gee, you sounded good live that night. I said, oh, yeah, funny about that.
Yeah. And do you have any pre-show rituals, whether it's are you playing music in the background, or do you have any superstitions?
No, nothing. Pseudo Echo was the most half-assed band. We would be just bullshitting on, talking to each other. Sometimes I'd be talking to an old friend or something, and somebody'd go, hey, Brian, we're on. And it's like, oh, shit, I've got to go, sorry. And then I'd just bolt onto the stage, and away we'd go. So, yeah, it was never any traditional things that we did with Pseudos. It's always been funny. Like, everyone in their own world, and before you know it, somebody calls it and we're on. These days it's a bit more, official how we get on and the timing of when we get on, because it's got to work with the visuals and all the stuff. But, yeah, in those days we were just a bunch of kids mucking around playing
up
music.
Up you get and off you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
And your current band members, are they scattered around the country at the moment?
Sydney, Melbourne. Half. So that's kind of good, It would be nice if we're all together, because we could sort of hang more. It's really good. We're a real close band, so it's really
awesome.
Good.
Yeah.
Cool. Fantastic. You got anything else? Any
quick
more?
Five, five, on
was that one?
Was that five? Or
no, that's...
Three and a half?
Four. All right, we got one more.
Four. Have we got one more?
I could ask myself one. No, you...
Oh, God, we're losing listeners as we speak.
No, they're tuned in.
I can hear the crickets already.
Yeah, all right, I'll think of one more. For any upcoming artists, and we bang on this every show, actually. We're really big on supporting local live acts.
Yeah, sure.
The music industry is more than just people playing at arenas and festivals and big gigs.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for those up-and-coming artists who are playing at pubs, trying to make a name for themselves with some originals? I know it's a big... But for people who may be listening in that situation, like you might have been, what's the big takeaway?
Well, I think that, passion is really important with music. I think if you're thinking about a money-making venture, just think again.
Yeah.
From that level I'm talking about.
Correct.
It takes a long time before you're going to see remuneration in a big way in this business. But starting out, I think that should be your last priority about as a profession, as income, should be about passion. If you love your music and you love performing, it'll show, and that's the real key. I think finding your thing is incredibly important, and by that I mean, your own identity, your own sound, your own look. Whether you're playing covers or you're doing originals, it's still, I think, if you're going to do covers, just do your own thing with them,
Twist them.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be exact.
Look, everybody can do the cover the same these days. You download a bloody backing track and, add water and away you go. I think it's better to put your own interpretation on them, because firstly, you're not going to be directly comparable, because that's a bad idea, being compared to some fantastic smash hit. And then you're doing your half-assed version with acoustic and stamping your foot, you're better off to take it in a new direction.
Absolutely, I agree. Improvise what you're doing.
That's right.
Well.
More of you.
Yeah.
And you already got the great songs if you're doing covers. And if you're doing originals, same. Just, keep them short and sweet and blend them in with the... when I started, I used to just get obscure songs. If I didn't have my own songs, maybe when I started I had three or four songs that I'd written. And I'd just go and find through a record collection obscure bands like The Sparks or Bruce Woolley and the Camera Club, who were, before the Buggles. I'd find these sort of bands, and I'd go through their albums, and I'd find the great songs that weren't hits necessarily.
They were just
great songs.
Yeah.
And I'd cover those.
Yeah.
So I kind of had an original set written by pros.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Good idea.
Good idea.
Well... That'll probably take us to the wrap up today, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Great, thank you.
Love the chat. We'll have to. I could do it again, to be honest. Just to just the scallywag talk of having a laugh and all that. I know four of us back here as well. We just seem to enjoy it. It's great fun. But thank you very much for coming in today. Yeah, really appreciate that.
Thanks. So you've
downloaded
on High Voltage.
Yes, follow our Facebook page, High Voltage, and we're on Spotify as well with our podcast. A bit of a plug. We're on Spotify as well. We've got our episodes up, and we've got Instagram too. My partner's running the Instagram side of our
page.
So fantastic. But yep, jump online, grab tickets to the Funky Town tour that's coming up for Pseudo Echo, and we'll see you all in 2 weeks' time. Hope you have a great day.